My name is Gets Crazy Boy. I am 27, turning 28. I'm a youth worker from Fort McMurray region. My parents, my mom's Blackfoot. My dad is Dene from Fort Chip. I have a lot of family friends and youth that I work with that are from Fort Chip.
So Fort Chipewyan is kind of ground zero in a lot of senses to looking at the impacts of the tar sands on the environment and also the health of indigenous communities close to the tar sands operation. Can you maybe just illustrate what are some key points for you in regards to environmental and health impacts via tar sands?
I think that Fort McKay, which is located about 20 kilometers downstream from the tar sands, is often overlooked in Fort Chip. Fort Chip is a few hundred kilometers downstream, but both these communities, and the reason for Fort McKay, I guess, is that they're very progressive in their dealings with industry. Their chief, who a lot of people call the emperor, he just kind of does what he wants, and he signed away and leased away all the land around the res. So for them, they are in like essentially the heart of the tar sands extraction. They're surrounded by it. There's certain times of the day in Fort McKay where you can't be outside. They have an alarm system in case something happens. Everybody has to go inside. Currently right now, you can't drink any water from the taps. You can't take showers because after a certain degree, there's a chemical that gets activated. It's horrible for your skin. During the mornings, you can actually wipe off a film from your car, which is from the smoke of the tar sands. That's McKay. You don't really hear a lot about that because they just sign away everything and they kind of put a muzzle on everybody else.
And have you visited this community?
Oh yeah, I got friends. Like I got friends and family in McKay. We're pretty close out there. It saddens me. And these people have, or the people in McKay, they've kind of benefited. They'll get money, thousands of dollars, not a whole bunch, not as much as you would think from a multi-billion-dollar industry, but they get like these little tiny crumbs. Reservations are, you know, statistically these poverty places all over North America. Nobody wants to be poor. So for them to get a little bit of extra, it's, you know, to provide for themselves and their families, it's kind of a blessing in a way where they can get access to better, you know, healthcare or just have a little bit of the extras being so poor in these communities. But now at this state of where their situation with the water is, which is just the last couple of months, and they're really finding the devastation, a lot of the people now are very angry at their leadership. To the point where they just want to oust him, like, tomorrow. That's Fort McKay. Fort Chipewyan is located downstream. They just released a report last year from, I think his name was Dr. Schindler of the U of A, and they did water testings on it. And they found there was, like, 13 inorganic materials that were coming out of the tar sands. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are cancer-causing. And what industry had said was that they're concentrated around tar sands, but the Athabasca watershed was so, there's so much, you know, gallons of water that are going through that they just kind of fade away. What they found, though, was that in Chip, there's kind of a bend in the river, and all the inorganic material is condensing near Fort Chipewyan. You know, so we've been saying it for years now that the water is killing us. And now there's finally proof that the water is killing the people, that there's rare types of cancers that are happening, a rare aggressive type of cancers. People are getting cancers and tumors left and right. My auntie just recently got chemotherapy because she got sick, took her to the doctors, and they said, oh, you got this one type of cancer. And then she went back about a week and a half later, and they said, no, you got two types of cancer, not just the one, but two. And she had to undergo chemotherapy. She lost all her hair. Thought she was going to die, but fortunately, she just came out of it. Other people aren't so lucky up north, though. I mean, there's a rare bile duct cancer, which if you get it and it's left untreated, I think you have like a 4 to 6 weeks of a life, and then you're gone. And then if you get treated, it's anywhere from 3 to 6 months. Dr. Connors was a doctor who got disbarred in Alberta for causing undue alarm because what he said was he was seeing this rare type of cancer, never seen before in his practicing, being a doctor. He was seeing it time and time again in northern Alberta, specifically Fort Chip. And then he reported that they discredited him. He got disbarred from Alberta, and then he came back. He just got reinstated this past year. This cancer should affect 1 in 100,000 people, unfortunately, statistically speaking. 1 in 100,000 people should get this. But in the community of Fort Chip, which is less than 2,500, they had 7 reported cases so far of this rare type of cancer. And we think it's a lot higher because everybody's dying up there from cancer. I mean, there's been 2 deaths recently. One was an accident. My good friend passed away. He crashed his skidoo. And another one was an elder who just passed away. But aside from those 2 deaths, there have been literally, they've all been cancer or people getting sick from different things up north in Fort Chip. Mm-hmm. This community predominantly lived off the land. You can canoe down the Athabasca River like 15 years ago and drink out of it. It was that clear, that pristine. You could kill the animals, eat the animals, whether it was moose, elk, whatever. Now we're finding that our fish that are coming out of this water have tumors. They're having, my buddy had a, he caught a fish, he froze it and kept it for the longest time, but he had this fish with two mouths. The hottest days, the trout, they're having a fungus on their gills. Muskrats no longer come up north because when they were coming up north, they're finding that their eyes, their nose, and their ears were bleeding. The caribou, the elk, the deer, we're finding when we kill them, they're having tumors in their body. Mm-hmm. They're having the sickness in there, so nobody eats that anymore. They're getting all their water bottled and flowing up to them right now.
So we're talking about a reality that really undermines the traditional food systems of First Nations communities around the tar sands.
Yes, yeah. Danisuthanay, that's what I am. The translation of that is people of the caribou. Because a direct result of the tar sands, whether it's in situ or surface mining, the caribou population now has 30 years left before they're completely extinct. This is where we were completely, you know, sufficient, living off the caribou and other animals as well. But I don't know what you can compare this to if you're of a different, if you believe in a different deity, you know, if you believe in a different religion, but it's to take the core essence and not have it there anymore. Our cultural way of life that we've had is gone. And a lot of people, Canadians, say, well, you should be able to progress there into this society. You know, people, you should be able to assimilate into our ways. And that is an option. But the option for anybody to practice their beliefs, their indigenous beliefs, should always be on the table. The option to go back and reclaim all this, you know, ancient wisdom from the ancestors should be there for anybody, you know, coming from your direct bloodline. And when assimilation stops being voluntary or integration stops being voluntary for whatever reasons or variables, you then move on to cultural genocide, you then move on to ethnocide. It's a really hard situation to be in, you know. People who say we should be, the native peoples or indigenous peoples in Fort Chip or wherever should be able to, you know, why are they always stopping progression? Why can't they just evolve? When you say that, you're actually putting that out to the rest of the world. And the reality is that everybody's evolving in their own way. Every culture, every indigenous nation, every nation around the world is evolving in their own way. Some just want different things, you know. I was down with the Achuar Nation down in Ecuador last year, and they're, like, self-sufficient off the land. There's little things that they want from society. Maybe the ability to speak, you know, globally. That's about it. Everything else they said you can keep. You can keep your guns. You can keep, you know, maybe there's certain things with medicine as well that they want in. But this consumeristic model they don't want. Mm-hmm. And to say, why can't these people be like us? Why can't they evolve? What you're essentially saying, whether you know this or not, it's very eocentric. It's very racist. You're saying to these nations, mm-hmm. you are failures until you evolve into us. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't realize that. A lot of people do as well, but most people don't realize this. We are not failures. Mm-hmm. You know, we have our own system. We have our own way of being. Mm-hmm. If you look at the way this North America was before colonization and the abundant amount of resources we had, plus our huge populations, and you look at it now, what would you consider, you know, evolving? Mm-hmm.
Can you describe a bit from your perspective, having, you know, spent time in communities surrounding the tar sands, First Nations communities, how does it look on the ground? What's the very kind of physical reality of the tar sands? What are some key kind of images or points that you feel would be important to convey to people?
I think that it's weird to say, but I grew up with the tar sands. And I knew they started like back in like 67 or whatever, but being born in 1984, moving out to McMurray in 1989, I was really able to see the tar sands grow to what they are right now. And you didn't really notice it. Like, it was just there. And you just normalize it after a certain period of time. You know? It's just like, oh, that's the plants, and that's how Canada works. But then when Kretchen came up and said this is the next hotspot, when Kretchen was in power, there was a huge population surge in McMurray. There was this big population boom, and tar sands growth started growing exponentially, just crazy. And within the last 10 years, though, the expansion, specifically from Suncor, which you can see from driving up Highway 63, has been insane. And then when you do an overhead, if you've ever done an overhead of flying through, to actually see this industry is just, it's insane, you know? I mean, like, with just the Athabasca River alone, we've seen the water drop if you've ever boated through it, if you start upstream, like way before the tar sands, you go right back to the glacier, you can drink out of that, and then you can see it change along the way, and then it becomes like a soup when you're around the tar sands, and then the water changes so much, the water level drops, it smells, you know, people want to drink it, it still has a funny taste. But the things we've seen, like just on ground level, along with the population boom, came a drug influence within Fort McMurray, and it was crazy. It was like off the scale. I was working with kids, 8 or 9, that would come talk to me. The ages 8 or 9 that would come talk to me about, you know, finding crack pipes or seeing their parents or their parents' friends or their cousins getting high off crack.
On the point of drugs, for you as a youth worker, what is the relationship between the marginalization of First Nations communities close to the tar sands, economic, political marginalization, and drug use? What's the connection?
In McMurray, the city alone, it was like crazy. It was really off the wall how bad it was. Most of those people were non-natives. Certain reservations have their land deals better with the tar sands. So Fort McKay, for instance, since they leased everything, they had a lot of money coming at one point. Some of the band members there were really getting into this drug and alcohol addiction. Fort McMurray First Nations, it's there. It wasn't really that bad. But you got to realize that these problems, the drug and alcohol problems, didn't start with the tar sands. They started after the residential schools. And these are like Northern Alberta, the residential schools were off the radar with their child and sexual abuse and physical abuse as well. So a lot of those people came out had PTSD, not really, and being at the time when you got off the res, you had to have a piece of paper that said you could leave the res to get a job or to do whatever, meaning to vote up to a certain year, you had to give up your Indian status. So it's either you leave your family and your friends and journey off into like society, or you stay there. Unfortunately, what they did was created a cesspool of all these social problems. And Canada fostered that growth. I work with kids. Their parents are PTSD survivors or post-traumatic stress disorder survivors from the residential schools, or their grandparents were that, and their parents are raised by PTSD. And it's hard. It's a really, really hard place to be. It's a hard place to work because you see all this potential between these people, these youth. You see how healthy they are, but then you see these skeletons come out from these people who, for whatever reason, keep going back to that place that's in their lives, you know, going back to the residential schools. They live it out. So the drug problem didn't start with the industry, but when money started coming in, it's like giving an alcoholic money, or it's an alcoholic on payday. Mm-hmm. You know, the first thing they're gonna do is go feed their addiction.
Well, you can see historical parallels to drug addiction problem in the United States within the African American community, also historically a community in struggle. And in the 1970s, after the liberation struggles, that was a huge challenge also faced, you know, in Brooklyn, Detroit. But today in Canada, I'm wondering, what are some central questions that you have about what people who live within the borders of this country, Canada, should consider in regards to the tar sands? What does the tar sands say about Canada? What should we be critically thinking about in terms of the direction of Canada?
When you hear production and expansion, that coincides with destruction. And that is, you know, surface mining completely destroys the biodiversity, the ecosystem within an area. I mean, for every 1 barrel of oil produced with strip mining, there's about 1 barrel of waste produced as well. With in situ, depending on the people or the company, it's anywhere from 1 barrel of oil produced to 0.5 barrels of oil waste to 5 barrels of waste. So 1 barrel of oil for in situ could be 0.5 to 5 barrels of waste, depending on the company. What you have to grasp is that this is such a huge environmental disaster. Even the massive amounts of water that they use, for 1 barrel of oil for surface mining, it's 2 to 4 barrels of water, you know. In situ, it's one of those things where it's 0.5 or it's to 4 barrels of water. And it's massive amounts of water for in situ. It's more water in situ mining, which they're, surface mining is being phased out. The next phase is in situ. The whole entire idea that in situ is greener is a fallacy. It's a lie. There's so many plants going up right now that they don't really completely wipe out biodiversity, but they cut enough holes within our biodiversity that the net is essentially useless, the biodiversity net, all plants, animals, and species found within. You got to understand that it equals destruction.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.